Welcome to the Locate 852 podcast, bringing you insights on how you can build and scale your business with social platforms. Hosted by the leading Facebook ad strategist in Hong Kong, entrepreneur, branding expert, and the founder of Locate 852, Chris Chung.
Sean, thank you so much for being on the show. We have a lot of, I know, even more than a few mutual friends that we like to talk about off camera. But thank you so much for being on. I know you have an incredible story as well. But for the people that don't know you, can you take us all the way back to baby Sean? What was your upbringing like, and what was your childhood like?
Holy smokes, you don't know this about me. My father was in the military, so I grew up in Okinawa, Japan. I was born in Kansas City, Missouri. My father then took a tour in Okinawa, and I was there for my first 6 years. So my mother is Japanese, but Japanese American. My father is American, was in the military. We lived there. Then we kind of bounced around, and I think that's super important, right? If my father was stationed in Okinawa, then he was in North Carolina, and then we moved to Indiana. And so because of that, that kind of shaped, you know, somebody that moves around a lot. When you're super young, you have to adapt, and you have to be adaptable as far as friends and meeting people and school and new starts, etc. Eventually, we sort of settled in Indiana. Decided to go to chiropractic college and started on a chiropractic career. So I'm a chiropractor by profession. And then because I had that in my blood, and then I'll let you dissect any parts of this that you want to, graduated chiropractic college from St. Louis and moved immediately to Costa Rica. I practiced in Costa Rica for 8 years before moving back to the States. So I've had plenty of international travel and experience, and that also shapes, right, the way that one is. Your worldview gets formed by your experiences as you grow up. And so I do have a lot of sort of international worldview in me. Very few parts of the world that I haven't traveled to or enjoyed. And so that sort of created the timeline of my trajectory.
And when you were growing up, how would you describe yourself? Were you a confident kid? Were you outgoing? How would you describe yourself?
Well, I was an only child, and moving a lot spurs your creativity, right? So I, of course, had invisible friends that I talked to, and had to learn how to play by myself a lot. Super creative. If you have imaginary friends, that's pretty dang creative. I think I had an imaginary monkey as well. So people thought, you know, I would tell people like my pet monkey, and they were like, what is he? They would ask my mom, does he really have a pet monkey? And she was like, no, that's his imaginary friend, the pet monkey. That caused me to engage a lot of the creative side. But also, I think that, you know, there is the academic side. If you are an only child and you're switching around schools a lot, you are able to develop that academic side, because, you know, that's what you're doing. I wasn't super engaged with friends. I did a lot of extracurricular activities. I was super into soccer, super into music. Those are the two things that when I was in high school, I kind of thought would be my profession. So those are also very, you know, creative, vision oriented things. I thought I wanted to be a professional soccer player or a professional musician until I took a course at Indiana University in the music school. And I realized how good everybody else was compared to me. I mean, I was good in high school, but not in college. So I had to figure out what I was actually going to do with my life. But I think all of those things, you know, sort of spurred that creative side. And I think that I was blessed to get the balance, you know, more on the analytical side as well.
And did you play any sort of instruments?
Oh yeah, I played the saxophone. Nice. Played the saxophone. I was the drum major of the band. So yeah, I was super into music. We had a jazz band. We played, we played around at different events and parties in the country club. And so, I mean, being in high school, I thought I must have been really good if I was getting paid to play music, but I wasn't that good.
So from the music side, you had a huge passion for. How did you then transition into more so the chiropractic side?
Well, my cousin was a chiropractor, and he was a super inspiration for me. for those that don't know, the chiropractic profession, well, anything in the medical field during the 1980s in the United States, it was super well paid. It was the Mercedes 80s, insurance coverage for everything. And so my cousin did extremely well financially. And that was something that was appealing to me. And then also on the chiropractic side, he was very into chiropractic. He really pushed me to go to chiropractic college. I went to Indiana University. I completed my prereqs in 2 years. And then I actually stayed for a third year. And I kind of tried to convince myself that maybe I wanted to go into pre-med. And my cousin, he was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He flew down to Bloomington, Indiana to meet me and basically scold me and tell me to get into chiropractic college. I'm very thankful for that to this day. I had graduated high school a year early, so I didn't really lose, I didn't lose a year age-wise. So I was able to graduate chiropractic college when I was 24. And look, you know, most 24-year-olds, if you can relate to this, I mean, I knew everything, right? Like I had nothing. I knew exactly what I was going to do and how the world works. So I moved to Costa Rica. One big giant problem, I didn't speak Spanish, and that's the primary language there. So my first year there was an absolute struggle because I couldn't communicate with people, and I was practicing a profession that requires a lot of communication. But then after my first year, I sort of got my feet underneath me and had a couple breakthroughs and began to find some degree of success.
Now, being a chiropractor, I'm sure before, you know, we dive into the business side of things, there must be a few funny stories of being a chiropractor for so many different years. Can you share with us before we go into the business side of things, a few of those funny experiences?
Well, they're funny but they deal more with the language. I had another chiropractor, dear friend of mine, who has since passed away. His name is Andy Roberts, and he practiced with me down in Costa Rica. First of all, I mean, we had big business. Like, we were seeing probably 300 patient visits in a day. We were working, there's only the two of us, and we were working 12 hours. So we kind of staged it. Like, so we worked 8 and 8, and there was a 4-hour overlap there. We actually lived in a house. So it was a 2-story. So I lived on the first floor and he lived on the second floor, and I would wait for him to come home. And when he would come in the door, and I would say, "Hey, come over here." And we would just, you know, chat for a little bit before he'd go up to his place. And one day he came in and he said, "You're not going to believe this. This is the craziest thing. A guy came in today, and this guy's name was actually Asdrubal." And I was like, "That's a funny name, Asdrubal. Who names their child Asdrubal?" Well, it turns out it's a pretty common name in Costa Rica. We had just never heard of it. So we were like, "Somebody's name is Asdrubal?" And so we were laughing about it. A couple days go by and he comes back in, and I was like, "So how was the day?" And he's like, "Oh, you're not going to believe this." And I said, "What?" He goes, "I mean, and remember, we were seeing a lot of people, like 300 people every single day, and they all had names. You know, we're two Americans in Costa Rica, and they have Latin names. We're not able to like really recall people's names." And he says, "Remember I told you about that guy Asdrubal?" And I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I went out in the waiting room and I called Asdrubal back, and he came back in the room, and I was like, 'Hey, what's going on, Asdrubal?' And he was like, 'Oh, what's happening?' And he said, 'Hey, so let's check you.' And he said, I laid him down and I checked his nervous system. And then I was like, 'Hey, so we're going to give you an adjustment.' And the guy was like, 'Okay.' And he's like, 'Come on, just like last time.' And so he put the guy down and he adjusted him in his neck, and the guy was like, 'Whoa.' And then he took him after their adjustment. There's a period of time where they kind of rest in these beds. He said, I took him back into the beds, and I came back up to my desk, and I picked up the next patient file, and the guy's name was Asdrubal. He goes, 'Can you believe there's two Asdrubals?' Well, the guy that he called back was brand new, had never been in. And so he calls Asdrubal, and it was his very first time ever. And he just walks back there, and Andy says, 'Hey, come on in. Let's just get you checked.' And he adjusts Asdrubal, but it wasn't the right Asdrubal. And so his very first experience was that. He's like, 'I can't believe there's two people with this name.' And, you know, and it's a fairly common name. And in the United States, it'd be like John or Mike. Right. It's like, you're going to find a lot of those people. But we had no idea. So we didn't even pay attention. We just thought, like, there's only there's only one Asdrubal, right? And so that was one of the funnier ones.
That's so funny. So when was that point, you know, you started from 24, you moved over there. And when was the point where you started to make a decent amount of financial success from what you're doing?
Well, it was at the end of my second year. And I think that's really important to qualify that. At the end of my first year, I was broke. At the end of 1 year being in Costa Rica, I really had to consider, should I throw in the towel? My Spanish was terrible. Towards the end of my first year, I caught a break and I was invited onto a TV show. It was a nationally televised morning show. It was, you know, seen by the entire country. And I really prepped for this. I guess this is kind of a funny story, but there's a business lesson in it too. I knew that my Spanish wasn't up to par. And so I figured that there was a certain number of questions that they could possibly ask me. I figured that the first question they would probably say is, "Hey, Sean, so what's chiropractic?" So I had hired a guy to help me to formulate my answers to the most logical questions that they would ask. And I memorized them in Spanish. And I thought I was all ready to go. And I go on the television and the host, the very first question that she asked me, she said, "You know, Sean, you look a little bit Asian and, you know, you're a chiropractor, but what really is the difference between chiropractic and acupuncture?" And I was like, what? Like, I didn't even have that answer ready. So here's what I did is I just said a response to something I had rehearsed. And it didn't match the question. I mean, we could try it with you. Maybe I just start answering random things, regardless of what you asked. And she kind of looked at me. So she asked me another question. And I answered an answer that didn't match the question. I was just saying these things like chiropractic. And I was telling her these things. And she was looking at me really strange. And of course, my Spanish was terrible. And I walked off the set and I was like, I just bombed. Like, that's terrible. I lost my big chance. And that was at the end of my first year and I had no clients and I had no money. I literally was taking these plastic recyclable bottles. I had just sort of thrown them on our back patio because for me, like we don't have that in the United States where you return them, but there was a deposit on them. And so I was just putting them in the back and I literally had these giant trash bags and I put them in these bags and I carried them to the grocery store. And I said, "I want to return my bottles. Like, can I get my deposit back?" And they were like, "Yeah, but not like for like two or three, not, we can't do all of your bottles." So I literally had to go to like five or six different grocery stores to turn my bottles in. And at the end of that, when I had all of my deposits back, I had just enough money to buy one bag of rice and one bag of beans. That's all I had. And I had to consider, should I throw in the towel? Well, lucky for me, I decided to give it one last go. And even luckier, the television show called back and they wanted me to come back on the show. Years later, I became a regular monthly guest on the television show and it really helped me to build my business. But years later, I asked her, I said, "Why did you invite me back?" And I think this is a really important lesson for anybody who's watching. On both sides of this coin, she said to me, she said, "You know, Sean, when you first came on the show, I had no idea what you were saying. I literally didn't understand a word you were saying. In fact, the answers didn't even match the questions and the answers didn't even make sense." She said, "But I could tell when I looked into your eyes that you had something very important to share." And she said, "And you don't know this, but when you walked off that set, I looked at our producers and I said, 'Get him back.'" And they were like, "What?" And she said, "Get him back and keep inviting him back until he gets it right." Look, I think that for a lot of people, if you have a conviction, and I love to talk about that, we can talk about that a little more, but history only remembers people who had a conviction stronger than their desire to please. And if you have a conviction, you don't care if you're botching the interview, you don't care if your blog post has spelling mistakes, you don't care if your video is not quite right, but you have a conviction stronger than your desire to please or be perfect, that's what people can really connect with and resonate with. But also, look, some people that you're in a position where you found your success, And sometimes you realize that there are people that come your way that probably aren't as polished or don't communicate well, but you can tell in their eyes that they have a story to tell. It's also your moral responsibility to keep giving them a chance to get it right. If that wasn't for that person giving me that chance, you and I honestly wouldn't be speaking today.
So you had to, you know, you were struggling on the second year, and then you were thinking about throwing in rope, say, hey, we're done. I'm done. What was it that actually took you to give it another shot and then make it work? What was the different steps that you took?
Well, first of all, I had to find my purpose. And for me in that moment, you know, if I was throwing in the towel, that was an admission of defeat that probably wasn't meant to be a chiropractor. It probably is not totally true because I could have been a great chiropractor potentially in the United States speaking English. But for me, I that wasn't the plan. I wasn't going to go back to, I was going to have to go back to the States and do something else, work in a restaurant or do whatever. And so I had to look at my core purpose, number one, and realize like, if I was put on this planet to help these people, I need to figure it out. Like I need to get my Spanish game strong and I need to learn how to communicate this. The second thing that is really important, I mean, and it won't have a lot of context for everybody, but if you just sort of apply it to yourself, I wasn't really being true to the practice of chiropractic as I learned it. So I learned it in a certain way. And then I thought like, well, yeah, but what if we did it this other way? Like it would be way better if we did this other thing. And I realized that my mentors that had taught me, they had found success doing it the way that they had taught me. And then by modifying it, I had deviated from something that works. Mm-hmm. And I then also had to have a, you know, sort of a realization that, look, if these people that had come before me had found a formula that works, I would be wise before I start changing it. And look, I'm not opposed to you changing it, but I should probably walk that path that they walked so that I could understand how they got to where they are before I start to interject my own thoughts or opinions about it. And so really reeling myself back to the essence of what I was doing was another critical thing. And then lastly, you know, I think, you know, effective communication is key. I had to be able to speak the language so that I could connect with people and that I could communicate to them who I was, what I stood for, and what I could deliver into their world. Service providers around the world that have something big to offer the world, it's not good enough just to be fired up about it. I mean, we're going to have to, and you of all people know, in your field, we have to effectively communicate or people just won't know we exist.
When you were at the 24, 25 age, you said you had to first find your purpose. Was there someone in your life that provided that guidance and guided you towards how you should do that effectively? Or was that something that you just thought that, hey, since it's not working right now, I got to figure something out. And the purpose was the next logical step. And was that a conclusion that you drawn in your own head?
Well, I think both. I think that, so I had mentors. You know, people that I admired and that I admired from afar, people that I listened to speak, people whose books I read, all of them in the chiropractic profession. But then also I had to have that realization, right? I mean, the ego gets in the way. All of us think that, you know, we know best and it's very humbling when you think you know best and it doesn't work. I mean, and if you really want to be humbled, and I hope that people don't have to experience this, but if you really want to be humble, like lose all of your financial ability, right? And then, you know, like sell these little plastic bottles. Like I was literally like begging these grocery store clerks, you know, and they're just doing their job. They're like, "Guy, we can't take 50 of these bottles." I was like, "Please, how many can you take? Because I need to buy food." The thing is that at the end of the year in a Latin American country, it really does shut down for basically the last 2 weeks of the year. I mean, they're celebrating the holidays. And so what that meant for me was I didn't have any income. And when that meant I didn't have any food. And so I was trying to figure out like, how am I even going to make it through these last 2 weeks? And so that humble pie that we get fed causes you to have to reflect. I mean, I can clearly remember it was New Year's Eve, exactly 1 year into my practice. Like everybody, I could hear people, you know, shooting off fireworks and they were banging on pots and pans. And I was laying in my bed because I didn't even have enough money to go out. I couldn't even have like a Coca-Cola, let alone be like with friends having a drink or a meal. And I was listening to all of these people celebrating right then, like you have to take your medicine, right? And I had to realize that I need to find a solution. And the best place, look, for everybody, the answers lie inside, right? The answers lie inside of you. And so that moment of reflection, it was forced reflection. I wasn't like a meditator or anything. A forced reflection caused me to look inside, because literally when you're stripped of everything, that's all you have anyways. You just have yourself. Nobody, I didn't have friends in Costa Rica. Remember when I went, I thought I had it all figured out. 1 year later, I realized like I'm just there and I don't know anybody and nobody's here to pick me up or help me. And there is a sense of freedom of throwing in the towel and going back, but there's also a sense of defeat. Mm. And I didn't want to go down like that. And so it was both. It was like mentors that I honestly wasn't following their advice. And then there's also that, you know, forced reflection that causes you to look inside.
So what was then the turning point in order to see things start to pick up?
Man, I just think that it was literally in that moment. Like, so, you know, you have to make a decision. You're either going to go back or you're going to stick. If you're going to stick, then you have to do it to 110% of your ability. The other part of that is if you're going to stick, you really have to, I think you have to be honest with yourself about what you've done to get yourself to that point. I mean, again, you know, another lesson of life is life. Your life is designed by you. Like you're not a victim. Like you created this, and there is accountability in that moment. It would have been easy to be like, look, you know, I don't speak Spanish, and you know, there's a lot of reasons why this didn't work, but there's a realization when you look inside, like, look, ultimately I'm accountable for this. And so I literally think like it was that New Year's Eve, like I was either going to wake up on the first and begin my journey back home, or I was going to wake up on the first and I was going to get it done. Like there was just like no turning back. And especially because I didn't have anything. So either I was going to get it done so I could eat, or I was not going to be able to eat. I was going to lose my apartment, right? I was going to, there comes that moment when you get pushed back against the wall and you really get to find out what you're made of. And for me, that was that moment. I mean, it was that New Year's Eve as I turned that point, that corner going into the new year. I didn't know that they were going to call me and give me another chance on the television, but I did know that even if they didn't, I did know that I was just going to pour every last drop that I had into this, that I wasn't going to accept defeat right there.
And was there some practical changes besides that? Some more so of the mindset and determination of saying, hey, I'm not going to throw in the towel. I'm going to give it all I have, and there's nothing to lose anyway. So I'm going to push forward. What were the practical stuff that you had to instantly change with the way that you were doing your practice or helping people in order to see a big change in the returns that you got?
Well, I didn't know it then, but I started to develop some practices that were very healthy for me, but also like to this day, now we have improved upon them and even teach them. But I have a book. I was journaling in this composition book, and I began to realize like I had to create the emotional stability and the mindset as if we were already there. Like literally, I think at that moment I had like 4 clients. That's not enough to pay the bills if you only have 4 clients. And so what I began to do is to go into my office. I had heard somebody talk about this act as if, and I literally though put it not only into emotional motion. So like, you know, we just completed this exercise with a lovely woman and mentor, Leslie Zan, and she was talking about her new way of goal setting. And I realized like, but I was doing this beforehand. And I wanted to see a lot of people. Like I said, we got up to 300 people in a day. So I began to just program my mind and understand what it would feel like to see that amount of people. But not only that, I began to do it. And this kind of goes back and ties back. Remember my invisible friends. So in my office, there was nobody there, but I would walk up to the front and I would speak out loud. I would say, hey, Chris, but there was nobody there. And I would say, hey, Chris, come on back. And I would walk to the back and then I would go through the motions and I would talk to you, but there was nobody there. And then I would say, okay, Chris, we'll see you Wednesday. And I would put invisible Chris in the appointment book at 10 o'clock because he had an appointment. And then I would go back to the front and I'd say, oh my gosh, it's so packed in here. Hey, James, come on back. And I would walk back and forth. And if anybody was spying on me, they would have thought I lost my mind. But then eventually real people would show up in that mix, right? And so then one of the things that that did, it has allowed me to have a rhythm. I knew what it felt like to see the volume of people that I wanted to see. And so then I would slot a real human being in the mix with my invisible clients. And I moved at the same pace because in my head, I was like, hey, I have to wrap this up. The waiting room is packed full of people, but it wasn't. But I would even tell them like, hey, I have to cut this short. We have to get moving. But what that did is it created that energetic space, one in my life, but also physical space. I understood the rhythm of what it looked like to see the volume of people. And then lastly, by journaling it, I understood what it felt like emotionally. And I think a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there. I understood the feelings that it brought, the actual emotions that it brought. And again, I think that ties back to my upbringing because I did grow up alone a lot and had these invisible friends and the emotional connection. A lot of times people are disconnected from their emotions. Like you say, like, how did that feel when you've made your first $1 million? And people say, good. I'm like, well, good's not an emotion, right? And so learning to connect to the emotion, because if we could put the emotion in front of the actual event, it helps us to manifest that. And so I didn't know any of that, but that's what I was doing. Those were the steps that I was doing. Last thing that I'll add too, and I know we will transition more into the tactical and practical application, but I began to understand the obstacles because I lived them the year before. And I began to be able to predict the obstacles and I would journal about them. I would be like, yeah, I remember when this happened and then how I felt. I felt defeated. And the lesson that I learned was, and then I realized that I could actually pre-learn the lessons in the obstacles before the obstacles presented themselves in real life. And that would allow me to pass through the obstacles or overcome the obstacles quicker. Now, fortunately, the story has a really happy ending. And there were a lot of obstacles that I could never have imagined that are, you know, people say like good problems. But look, before my friend Andy came down, I was working the 12-hour days, 300 patients a day. I literally couldn't figure out how we would deposit the money. This was an all cash environment because I worked from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. and the banks would be closed before I started or after. I literally had like a little man purse, a Tumi bag with like in millions of colones, thousands of US dollar equivalents in this little purse. And I didn't have a car. I would take public transportation and I would sit there with this little bag and I just had all this money in there. And I couldn't figure out like, how can I deposit this money? I couldn't figure out how to get my hair cut because I worked 6 days a week. And I was like, well, when I'm free, they're closed. Like, so some of these problems I couldn't anticipate and I couldn't figure out. But some of the challenges I knew because I knew myself and I knew, you know, what would happen. And I was able to overcome those in advance.
Wow. How long did you spend in Costa Rica before you then moved again?
I was 8 years in Costa Rica. And probably my proudest moment, in year two, I started the process of authoring the law that regulates chiropractic to this day. When I moved to Costa Rica, there wasn't even legislation or legalization of chiropractic. So at 26 years old, I began to author the law to regulate chiropractic. And at 27 years old, I lobbied for the passage of that law and in Spanish testified before the Costa Rican Congress on behalf of that law. That was super cool for me to experience. And then one of my big passions and dreams, and look, the way things operate in the universe, maybe something will flesh out of here. Every year, except for during the COVID restrictions, we do a mission trip to the Philippines. In fact, I was married in Cebu to my wife. Neither of us are Filipino, but we love the Philippines. And my dream is to, you know, the Philippines does not have an official law that regulates chiropractic there either. And we have some connections and my dream would be to author the law in the Philippines as well I don't think there's anybody on the planet that has authored two laws for two different countries to regulate chiropractic. So that's a vision and a dream of mine that I'm just throwing out there to the universe. Somebody listening is going to be like, oh my gosh, you know, my uncle's Manny Pacquiao. We could totally do this. And so if that's you, reach out to me. I'd love to do that.
Amazing. What made you move back to leave Costa Rica after 8 years in?
Well, I have two daughters, and they were in of school age, and I was paying private school for them to go, and I wanted them to also learn English. And look, private school in Costa Rica was like going to university in the United States. I was like, wow, this is an expensive venture to get my kids the same quality of education that honestly they could get at a public school in the United States. And so we began to make the process of moving back to the United States so my daughters could get an education here.
Wow. And so when you moved back, did you figure out how to work at the same time? Were you doing back and forth? What was that?
Well, we sold the business in Costa Rica. We had, at the time that I left, four different clinics. At our peak, we had four clinics. We employed six chiropractors, two medical doctors, and that was my first taste of scale. I'm not sure that I did it really well, but that's what we had. Then when I moved to the United States, remember I told you when I was 24, you know, 24-year-olds, we know everything. I never took the national boards to practice chiropractic in the United States. So I had to take several fairly big exams. And that meant that I was, you know, 8 years, 9 years out from having graduated. So I had to take some time to take some review courses, to study up, and then subsequently pass these exams. And while I did that, I took a job teaching at Life Chiropractic College West, just outside of San Francisco in California. And so that was kind of where I sort of got plugged back into the United States. Eventually, we opened our first clinic there in Dublin, in the East Bay, outside of San Francisco. And that began the process anew of scaling to the license model, to the franchises, and off we went.
And when you were making that money already, and probably even before that transition of coming back, were you being smart with your money? Were you putting your money into investments? Were you blowing it? What were you doing?
Yeah.
Let's hear some of those stories.
Well, as I started to get money, I really, I didn't know what I was doing, but I thought that I wanted to invest. I think that today too, you know, people have a lot of access to social media and the internet, and you can get a lot better advice. I didn't have that. I opened a sports bar. It was very popular. There's a lot of breakage and loss involved in the restaurant industry. I received and became a distributor for Glock firearms in Costa Rica, and was doing government contracts to sell firearms to the transit police and the police. I opened up a security company because of my contacts with Glock, and we were providing security at several of the major stadiums. But literally all of these businesses went wrong, right? Like they all got screwed up. There was a soccer match where, you know, the underdog team won. And so the fans stormed the field. They're, you know, we were providing the security, and now there's no security. The people are everywhere. The government contracts got messed up. We got super delayed on our payment. The bar, you know, tons of breakage there because, you know, it's super hard to control, especially if you're in a third world country. At the end of the day, when I moved back to the United States, I had gone from like, we were dead broke and I was selling the bottles to we had in Costa Rica living like kings. I had two houses, I had bodyguards, drivers. And then by the time I left, we were literally back down to zero. And so coming back to the States, I was literally starting over. Earlier today, I was having a conversation with somebody. What I think is interesting is that mentally, you hear this commonly amongst a lot of people that, you know, successful people had it and then they lost it and they had it and they lost it and they had it. But the thing about it is, and, you know, luckily for me, I was never bankrupt, but a lot of successful people have actually even gone to where they're bankrupt. But you begin to understand that money flows. And then you also begin to realize, like at that time was my first understanding that money flows, but I didn't have control of it. Like it just left. And then, but then you also understand like, yeah, but I could get it back. I think sometimes people live in a state of lack. or don't understand, you know, flow. And so they try to hoard it. And so they might have a financial success, but they don't allow that flow because they're afraid of losing it all. And I think that was my first lesson of how the ebbs and tides of success kind of move through your life. That allowed me then to get a better education, knowledge base of how to better invest than in, on my, you know, subsequent go arounds. It also allowed me to find a calmness, because remember when I described that first time when I was dead broke, I was scared. The second time when I was coming back to the States, I had a calmness because I knew like, well, we could get it back. I'm not going to sell firearms. And I really, again, for the second time, had that calling, right? So you come back and you have to look within, you have to find purpose. And I realized like I really wanted to focus in on the chiropractic side, that I wanted to build that part. What was I doing owning restaurants and selling firearms and all of this stuff? And so the foundation of what we do to this day still continues to be in the chiropractic space.
Wow. Knowing what you know now, if you were to give yourself some advice when you were making money already between that 26 to 30 year old range, how would you differ the way that you've spent your money? Would you have doubled down onto expanding your chiropractic businesses there before you didn't know you were going to move back then? But what would you have done?
I would have just learned the lessons faster. And I think that, you know, whenever we have like, you know, have conversations with, you know, your younger self, there is still like the way I envision that, like if I'm me, 50 year old me talking to, you know, 24 year old me probably doesn't listen to 50 year old me. The thing is that I think that if I could only do one thing, it would just be accelerate the learning curve. I'm very grateful for every lesson that life has brought. But I think that, you know, I think anybody's desire is let's just learn the lessons faster. If we can learn the lessons faster, we could get to where we are now. Maybe I could get here, you know, 5 years or 10 years earlier. But honestly, if I just told myself like, hey, don't do that. Don't open the sports bar. But then I wouldn't have learned the lessons that came with opening that. But then, and that means I wouldn't be where I am today, because I would be missing some critical lessons that, you know, shape my life, shape the decisions that I make. And so I would want to have the lessons. I would want to learn the lessons. And frankly, I don't know that a 24-year-old can learn the lessons just by somebody telling them. There is a degree of life experience that has to happen. You have to feel that pain. You have to feel that hardship so that you are reminded of the lesson, so that you learn the lesson faster. And then also so you apply the lesson, because I could have learned the lesson and just stayed broke. But the reason why I applied the lesson is because I wanted to eat. But sometimes if you're in a place of, you know, you're doing okay and the lesson shows up, you know, maybe sometimes too, like you have an investment and you know, maybe you lose $1,000 and you're like, whatever. You can overlook the lesson that you were meant to learn because it wasn't significant enough to you. And so for me, it really would be that I want to learn lessons as fast as I can, and I don't want to have to repeat them in life.
And especially, I think that ties into perfectly something that our mutual friend Dave says is always to ask for help, especially from people that have already experienced the success in the specific field that you're looking for. Since they've already paid the dummy tax, asking them essentially allows you to not have to pay it yourself. From coming back to the States to continue your becoming a chiropractor, how does that then move forward until what you're currently doing now with Black Diamond?
Well, then I was like, just, you know, full bore. I had learned the lessons. I was like, let's build this back as fast as we can. I was teaching at the chiropractic college. I opened up one office. The way that we practice chiropractic is very unique. You know, when people talk about your unique selling proposition, we do a type of chiropractic called upper cervical. And that means we only adjust the first two bones in the neck. We use a technology to measure the function of the nervous system. We don't adjust the patient on every visit. Like I mentioned before, after they get adjusted, they lay down, right? So it's not what people normally think. Also, the model that I know is the model from Costa Rica. So we tell people what they need. They pay us cash for it, and we provide the service. And that's unique in the United States, where there's third-party reimbursement, insurance reimbursement. Most providers accept insurance. I was like, why would we do that? Let's just have the person give us the money. And it worked. And so then other people were like, hey, how are you doing that? And I was like, well, maybe we're onto something. There's not a lot of people getting a lot of success doing this type of chiropractic and doing it for cash and not a little bit of cash. We were being handsomely paid. And so I was like, okay, so let's try and scale. And so we moved into this licensing model and I found 8 other people that were like, yeah, I want to try this. And so we began on this journey of seeing, could we replicate this and could we replicate it in other parts of the country? Maybe it was San Francisco, why it was working. So we had offices all over the United States and eventually we converted it over to a franchise where now today we have 13 offices. One of the things on that journey that I realized, and it actually happened to me while I was in Costa Rica. Costa Rica has 4 million people, 300 patients a day, times 5.5 days a week. I mean, we were seeing tons of people. We were averaging about $12 per visit. So that's why in Costa Rica, that's a lot of money. And then I came back to the United States for a chiropractic event. And I was at the event and a lot of people were like really sort of happy to see me. They were excited that I had successfully passed the law. There's a lot of excitement around being back. But I also realized that the chiropractors knew who I was, but like being in these other parts of the States, none of these other people knew who I was. Now, you have to remember, I was on television every month in Costa Rica. So in Costa Rica, generally, when I would go to restaurants, people would recognize me like, oh, that's the chiropractor. But in the United States, nobody knew who I was. And this is not an ego thing. What I realized is that I wasn't making a dent. I was like, man, like I feel like I'm doing all this work, but globally, like we're not doing anything. This is just a drop in the bucket. Like we're not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna be able to impact the world. So when I moved back to the States, that was also part of that, you know, journey. I wanted to expand into multiple offices and a franchise model. But beyond that, I realized that I wanted to touch more people outside of chiropractic. And I realized that the way that we were going to evangelize the message is we had to get people like you, Chris, to have on your show someone like me talking about chiropractic. And if I was just a chiropractor, and you had a chiropractor on not too long ago, John DeMartini, now you might not have talked about chiropractic with John. But we're talking about it with me because I wanted to leverage the influence in the platform to at least make sure that people still got that core message. And so the way that we did it was to help people be successful in whatever it is that they were doing, specifically service provider entrepreneurs. And that opened doors for me to be, you know, to meet people like Jordan Belfort and be on his podcast. And on that podcast, Jordan Belfort talked about chiropractic and David Meltzer, you mentioned earlier, and Patrick Bet David and John Rulon. My thing was like, can I get these thought leaders to at least talk about this? Because that's what's important to me. But the only way they would do it is if I was talking about and providing value into the areas that were important to them. So I became an expert in marketing and sales for service providers so that I could leverage a newfound platform to promote a message that was near and dear to my heart.
Wow. And how did you then develop from the chiropractic side, you know, being actually the person that adjusts people to then start developing, understanding how to do the marketing and also the branding side of things in order to grow, you know, a franchise and help other people as well?
Well, I would say that it's somewhat of a natural inquisition for me. I'm naturally inquisitive. I love human psychology, consumer psychology. I'm fascinated by what makes us make decisions. You know, right now we're living in a time, you know, where it's interesting. We're locked up in some places and we're not locked up in others. There's mandates. And I'm interested in what makes us make the certain decisions that we make. I'm interested in for consumers as far as health. I'm interested in entrepreneurs as far as success. What I find is that they're the same. And in fact, you know, I've had deep conversations with people that are deep thinkers that, you know, my mantra, you know, what I actually stand for is a world where health and success are known as fundamental truths rather than fundamental pursuits. Like we spend so much time trying to track down health. Like, you know, maybe if I did this diet or maybe if I, you know, took these pills or maybe if I did that exercise program. But look, honestly, it's the same thing on this side with with success. You know, maybe if I switch to ClickFunnels, or maybe if I, you know, maybe I should be on TikTok, or maybe if I bought this course, or we are always looking for these outside in things that we can bring to us to try and obtain a goal. But in reality, I realized that we're naturally programmed to be successful. That's the default setting. And we are also naturally programmed to be healthy. That's the default setting. But then what we do is we do things that interfere with our health, right? We drink a lot of soda or caffeine or the environment. We just do things that interfere with our expression of the health. But we also do the same thing on the success side, right? We make poor decisions. We have negative thought processes. We don't delegate our tasks because we try to do it all. We become perfectionists and we don't let the world see our truth because it's not ready yet. We do all of these weird things. And so I realized that there was that symmetry in those two fields, and that if we could break those lines of interference, we would see a better human expression, both in health and in success. And so when I found that, well, I started working with other entrepreneurs, other service providers, helping them to find that, to remove the interference. Then when it starts working, well, then other people start to take note, right? And then it gets easy. You just need a couple success stories under your belt, and then the rest of the path reveals itself.
You see a lot of different service providers, obviously with Black Diamond, what you're currently doing now, and also just across the board in the industry. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see, you know, other chiropractic service providers and even dental practices or businesses in similar nature make? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see them make that cause them, whether that be through the marketing side or the way that they set up their structure and their business, so they're not seeing the success they should be seeing?
Well, on a high level, 30,000 foot level, first of all, I'll say that they don't embrace the idea of being an entrepreneur, right? Like and look, this is in all services. So yes, chiropractors, medical doctors, dentists, lawyers, accountants, hairstylists, artists, you have a couple of beautiful pieces of art behind you, musicians, everything. You must embrace the idea of being an entrepreneur. You can't just be an artist. Why? Because then nobody will know you exist. And that's actually my charge. I think that the world's greatest providers, the best medical doctors, the best massage therapists, the best hairstylists, artists, social media, the best of the best, nobody knows who they are. The people who we think are the best are the ones who market the best. Mm. We don't know that they're the best, but they create visibility. They create trust and rapport. They engage the community. So we automatically are like, oh my gosh, they must be really great. You know, here in the United States, we have a lot of programming where there's doctors on TV, there's Dr. Oz. Well, Dr. Oz is a cardiologist. Very few people know that he's a cardiologist. What kind of doctor is Dr. Oz? Does he even practice? Is he any good? But he goes on TV, and because he's on TV, whatever he says is law, right? And so again, I've noticed, you know, in a lot of spaces, you know, in digital marketing space, it's the people that leverage their own skill to market themselves. They are the ones that people think are the best because they've done a great job of marketing themselves. That doesn't mean that they could market other people very well. There's other people that could probably slay at marketing other people, but because they don't market themselves, nobody knows who they are, right? And they just live in obscurity. So number one is you have to embrace the idea that being an entrepreneur is actually a moral obligation so that you could reach the people that you were put on this planet to serve. You know, there's nothing worse than wasted opportunity, wasted ability, wasted potential, because you just refuse to embrace, you know, the concept of selling yourself. Now, practically, I mean, man, we could just spend the next several days talking about this. And in fact, we could turn it over to you because it begins on the marketing side. One of the mistakes that a lot of people make is that they think marketing gets new clients. Marketing, what it does is it creates awareness. It creates awareness about who you are, what you stand for, and what you have to offer the world. Then sales is what converts that awareness into paying clients. So you have to be equally versed, especially if you're just starting out. You have to be a great marketer, and you also, though, need to be a great salesperson. Well, a lot of people are like, I don't want to be a salesperson. Like, that sounds sleazy. I don't want to sell things. But you have to, because if you don't sell things, then we're not going to have the financial resource to pay the bills. then you're going to close. And then the people that you were meant to serve, they're not going to get served because you couldn't keep your business open. So you need to embrace that. You have to sell. So you have to understand the difference between marketing and sales. You have to get good at both. And then lastly, man, you really have to have a strong mindset. You need to understand how money works in the world. You need to understand that money's not a zero-sum game. Sometimes people feel bad, like, oh, I feel bad charging people so much money for my services. Yeah, but your gain is not their loss, right? They have a job. They have a way that that money flows into them, and then it flows from them to you. And that's what keeps this whole world in a symbiotic relationship where we're sustaining each other. And you have to embrace that in order to be successful. And inside each of those things, marketing, sales, and mindset, there is even further, you know, application of what we should be doing to make yourself successful.
Sean, you've done, before I ask you my last question, you've done so many different interviews from being on TV every single week to Biggest Podcast, Jay Abraham, Patrick Bet-David, David Meltzer. What is one question that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question, actually. Man, I get asked a lot of questions too. Well, I guess and there's so much of these ones that are cliche. I'll just tell you an answer that I want to give that I didn't. How about that? Because I don't know the question Beautiful. That leads into it.
Beautiful.
I want to go back to that thing. I want everybody to realize this that's listening, because I know we have a lot of people that listen. I always say to myself too, because it doesn't matter the level of the platform. What matters is the level of the listener, right? And there are people, and I think that sometimes people, you know, obviously you have your following and you have your super fans of people that look up to you and admire you. And sometimes so people can think like, yeah, but that's not me. I'm not Chris, or I'm not Sean, or I'm not any of these other people. But here's the answer that I would have given. It goes back to this idea of having a conviction stronger than your desire to please. History remembers people that had a conviction stronger than your desire to please. And I love looking at history and seeing who history remembers. One of the things that we're going to realize is that the majority of the historical figures that get celebrated around the world, they were not famous. They were not privileged. They were normal human beings who stepped into their greatness. And my favorite, I don't know how this will translate around the world, but it does. I've done this conversation in Australia before, is Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. And Rosa Parks is a simple seamstress in the middle of a civil rights movement in the United States. And there were big figures then, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And then one day, this simple seamstress gets on this bus and she decides to change the course of history. And she sits down in the front. What oftentimes people don't recall is that the bus driver looked at her and called her by name. The bus driver said, "Rosa, what are you doing?" And what that means is that Rosa had been on that bus literally tons of times before, so much so that she was on a first name basis with the driver. What that means is that she had gotten on that bus over and over and over and over and over and over, and she sat in the back until one day something snapped and she said, "Not today." And on that day, a very simple seamstress impacted humanity. I mean, around the world, people know this woman and what she did and how it changed the course of racial relationships in the United States of America. A simple seamstress. I want every single listener right now to understand that every single one of us in our lives is afforded that Rosa Parks moment at some moment. And then when that happens, you have the chance to make a massive impact in the world. And here's what's very unfortunate. The majority of us do not seize the moment. We go to the back of the bus and we sit down. Because of that, the world's not changed. I want you to understand, you can't wait for Chris. You can't wait for Sean. You can't wait for all these people that you're seeing on social media to change the world, because it's not them who changes the world. It's you. But the only way you do that is by having a conviction stronger than your desire to please. And when that moment presents itself, you seize it and you say, "Not today. Today is the day that everything changes." Whether it's your business, your relationships, you're about to give up, you can literally change the course of history in an instant by deciding with your mind, by deciding to do something different. So that's the answer that I would have given to the fantasy question that you should have asked.
Sean, my last question for you is, if you were to be stripped away of all of your money, resources, and network today, and had to start all over again tomorrow, what are the first three things you would do and why?
I would make relationships. You said you cleverly said stripped away of your resources. I always say you can literally take everything away from me except this. do not take my phone. If I have my phone, I can get back in the game. Now, if I didn't have my phone, I would have to make relationships. I'm telling you that in today's world, relational capital is more valuable than any fiat currency, than cryptocurrency, than human resource. Relational capital is what plays. That's what I would do is I would just stay up 24/7. I would figure out where the people that I needed to meet that would get me back in the game, where they're hanging out. I would sit outside that wherever they were going, and I would engage them in conversation. I would do anything I could to add value. And once I had created enough value, I would make an ask, like you had said earlier, ask for help. But you can't ask for help unless you have the relationship. Step number one, create the relationship. If I lost everything, I'd go right back into relationship building.
Beautiful. Sean, thank you so much for being on the show. For the people that either want to keep up with what you're doing or potentially even work with you, where's the best place to find you?
Man, well, you already know this because you mentioned him earlier. You know, we do a lot of work with Dave Meltzer, and he's taught me this process. Here's my email, Sean, S-H-A-W-N, at blackdiamondclub.com. Shoot me an email. I'll send you a digital copy of our best-selling book, None of Your Business. Tell me you want the book. I'll shoot that over. If you have questions, I'll be happy to answer. If you want to know what we've got going on, just let me know. I'll send you any resource that you possibly want, because that's my Rosa Parks moment. If you ask, I'm going to do every single thing I can to deliver on that. And you know what's crazy, Chris? I did a bet with Dave one time. He spoke at one of our events. He said that in speaking in front of thousands and thousands of people, the most that anybody's ever engaged with him was four. I think it was four people. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, that's part of this thing. If somebody gives you the opportunity, whether it's me or David Meltzer or Chris, to engage with them, then you must seize that opportunity, because you never know. It just passes by. That could have been your Rosa Parks moment. Somebody could have that connection that you needed or that advice that you needed, but you didn't send the email. So if you're listening to this, hit me up, Sean at blackdiamondclub.com. I'd love to help you.
Sean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. You're the best.